Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, every January 6th, the Greek community in Tarpon Springs presents a unique Epiphany celebration.
This is the only place in Florida that has such a unique, ongoing, whole cloth pocket of European settlement.
Many people think of New Year's Eve as a drinking holiday. Some Floridians in the 1920s consumed illegal moonshine.
With no money for expensive legal representation and little knowledge of court procedures, the cases of poor moonshiners filled the courts during the last 5 years of prohibition.
New Year's resolutions to quit smoking are still popular, and we'll visit the Shade Tobacco Museum. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
Χρόνια και χρόνια τώρα τριγυρνώ σαν πουλί περιπλανόμενο μες στη ξένη τυγιά, μες στη μοναξιά που δεν την αντέχω άλλο πια. Γιατί νοσταλγώ, γιατί λαχταρώ την αγάπη μου και το χωριό.
In the city of Tarpon Springs, you can listen to Greek music, try the tasty pastry baklava, have a meal of lamb stew or a unique Greek seafood dish, sip the licorice-flavored alcoholic beverage ouzo, and enjoy many other aspects of traditional Greek culture. You can see the neo-Byzantine-style architecture of St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church and watch the sponge divers unload their catch on the city dock downtown. Tarpon Springs has the largest percentage of Greek Americans of any city in the United States. Even before the first 500 Greek sponge divers arrived in Tarpon Springs in 1905, a thriving town was already in place. The Diston land purchase of 1881, when Hamilton Diston bought 4 million acres of land for 25 cents an acre, led to the establishment of Tarpon Springs. Diston brought businessman Anson Safford to Tarpon Springs to stimulate development. Tina Bukovalis is curator of arts and historical resources for the city of Tarpon Springs and says that Safford moved into a small dog trot style cracker house.
They improved the house by adding a second story and expanding it. And it became quite a showcase, basically trying to show the elegant way that people could live in Florida at a time when this was really, in many ways, still kind of a frontier town. But through the influence of Anson Safford and Hamilton Diston and the wealthy northerners that came in, you know, there did Tarpon Springs did develop to become one of the early and very elegant resorts.
The Victorian home that Safford created can be enjoyed today. The Safford House Museum features period furniture and original family artifacts that preserve the home as it was in 1883. Soon after Anson Safford began developing Tarpon Springs, the Orange Belt Railway came to the town in 1887. The train depot is now a museum. Sharon Sawyer is archivist for the Tarpon Springs Area Historical Society, which operates the museum.
The building we're in was built in 1909 because the original railroad station burned down in 1908. And this was restored in 2005 to its original floors. You'll notice in the pine floors out front, and also the warehouse floors in the back are the original. The walls we've left with the writing on it, and so this was segregated when it was built. If you go out front, there's a colored waiting room and a white waiting room, and there was a wall in between the two that was torn down in the 70s, not until the 70s. The station master's room is the next room over, and we have exhibits in that, and then the warehouse area. We have pretty much the history of Tarpon Springs that you can go through. So it's a neat museum.
Displays at the Tarpon Springs History Museum include profiles of prominent physicians, including Dr. Mary Jane Safford. Mary was Anson Safford's sister and is believed to be the first female physician in Florida. Shelving and bottles from the 1880s drugstore are also displayed, along with artifacts from the Orange Belt Railway. Sharon Sawyer.
One thing about the railroad, it was brought here by Peter Demons, Demons Landing in St. Petersburg. He brought the railroad from Sanford to Tarpon Springs and then on down to St. Petersburg. And it was supposed to be the longest 12-gauge, I guess it is, railroad in the United States at that time. So before the railroad came, everybody had to get here by boat or wagon. So the railroad in 1887 made the big difference here in town, I believe.
It was the sponge industry, though, that really put Tarpon Springs on the map. By the mid-1800s, there was a thriving sponge industry in the Florida Keys, but by the beginning of the 20th century, Tarpon Springs was the largest sponge port in the United States. While sponges in the Keys were harvested with long poles, in Tarpon Springs, Greek sponge divers donned canvas suits with round metal helmets. Tina Bukovalis explains what makes the Tarpon Springs community unique.
Florida is the only place in the country that sponges grow, and the sponge industry was the biggest maritime industry in Florida, and we're talking millions in the late 19th century, which was quite something. Key West at that time, you know, in the 19th century, was a bigger producer. But once sponges were discovered in this area in 1873, the whole area from here up to Apalachicola became a hotbed of sponging. And eventually, Tarpon Springs became a market for sponges. And when Greeks came into this area as sponge buyers, John Kokoros, he realized that the way sponges were harvested in Greece would produce far more than the methods, the hooking methods they were using in Florida. So they brought over Greeks, and it was advertised that there was a lot of business to be done here. So at first 500 came in 1905, and then within a couple years there were 1,500, and there were lots of boats. And it very quickly made Tarpon Springs the sponge capital of the world. Tarpon Springs was a big, important town at a time when St. Pete was a wide place in the road. And there were buyers here from Europe. It was quite a place. Before long, I mean, within a couple decades, the Greeks were the majority. I would say they were the dominant population element, because there were several population elements. There were the Anglo element and the African American, which had a very big Bahamian influence because of the sponge industry. But for a long time, the Greeks were the dominant population element. So the fact that this was a big pocket of Greek culture and has remained so. I was talking to a friend of mine not long ago in Miami who's a cultural geographer, and she pointed out that this is the only place in Florida that has such a unique, ongoing, whole cloth pocket of European settlement. There are places with Latin American settlement, West Indian settlement, but European communities, this is unique in Florida.
With the large influx of Greek sponge divers and their families to Tarpon Springs, businesses to serve them were established, including restaurants, grocery stores, bakeries, and coffee houses. St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church was constructed in 1907 and expanded in 1943 with marble imported from Greece. The unique Epiphany celebration held on January 6th attracts people from around the world. Following a ceremony at St. Nicholas, the congregation walks to the sponge docks downtown, where a wooden cross is thrown into the water. The young man who retrieves the cross is believed to be blessed for the year. The Patriarch of Constantinople, who is the Greek Orthodox equivalent of the Pope, came to Tarpon Springs in 2006 for the 100th anniversary of the city's unique Epiphany celebration. Tina Bukovalis, former folklorist for the state of Florida, explains that there are many examples of Greek culture in Tarpon Springs.
I think in all instances in which there are large bubbles, you know, of population, such as with Cubans in Miami, you know, or Greeks here, you get more of a whole cloth culture. And here, the culture has been brought over pretty much whole cloth. I mean, as one writer pointed out, when the Greeks came to here, they actually changed their life very little from what it was in Greece because the climatic conditions were very similar. They were in the same occupations. They were living together, you know, and eventually they brought their families over in a certain part of town. You know, they brought the priests and religion in. And basically, it was very much like living in Greece. And so even today, you know, after people have been here, some people for four or five generations, you know, depending how quickly and when they came over, you know. There's still a big segment of the population that speaks Greek. I live in the part of town called Greek Town, and most of the people there are Greek, and most of the people there do speak Greek. And they get up in the morning and have Greek food and sweep out their courtyards, and which have various plants you might see in Greece, you know, and they'll have their coffee outside. And the old ladies in their headscarves will be going over to St. Michael's Chapel or St. Nicholas or whatever, or down to the bakery, the National Bakery down the street, which is a Greek bakery, or to Halki Market, which has been there for 100 years or so. The men will go, walk right by my house to go to the Kafenia, which are traditional men's Greek coffee houses. A lot of them who are old divers and things will go down to the sponge docks, which is a few blocks down the street, and just hang out at the docks to hang out with other old guys and see what the divers and things are doing. You know, it's, you know, the people with the gift shops, while it may look like tourist shops, the culture there is very much an active Greek culture. The dominant language is probably Greek. If you go down there, if I go down there to go to the Halki Market, I'll spend 2 hours, you know, talking to various people. You know, it's like living in a small Greek town with all the ups and downs.
Tina Boukavalis is curator of arts and historical resources for the city of Tarpon Springs. We also spoke with Sharon Sawyer, archivist for the Tarpon Springs Area Historical Society. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org, where you can find archived editions of this program, watch our public television series, Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, moonshining is something we commonly associate with the mountainous South, but Florida has its own history of opposition to the Volstead Act. In addition to moonshining, the illegal production of liquor, Floridians were also rum runners who smuggled alcohol into the state from Cuba, where there were no prohibitions on the manufacture and sale of liquor.
That's right. Florida has a complicated history with the Prohibition era. John J. Guthrie, Jr. adds a new dimension to the story in a 1994 article in the Florida Historical Quarterly titled Hard Times, Hard Liquor, and Hard Luck. He challenges earlier historiography that, quote, portrayed moonshiners as traditionalists attempting to preserve a way of life, and Democratic state officials universally hostile to federal authority, end quote. In this interpretation, neither the producers of illegal whiskey nor the oppositional state officials could prevent, quote, the development of an administrative apparatus capable of penetrating all parts of the nation's territory to carry out the mandate of prohibition. Focusing on state and federal court records in the later Prohibition era, 1928 to 1933, to understand the enforcement of the Volstead Act, Guthrie argues that the federal prohibition enforcement fell disproportionately upon persons who ranked near the bottom of Florida society. Arresting and convicting small-scale moonshiners proved more efficient and effective. The volume of arrests and convictions was used to, quote, demonstrate that lawlessness had reached epidemic proportions and justified the continuation of an unpopular constitutional amendment and enforcement act. Focusing on the smallest moonshiners, federal agents, quote, logged an impressive number of arrests, but failed to carry out the sophisticated undercover work needed to dry up the source of the supply, end quote. With no money for expensive legal representation and little knowledge of court procedures, the cases of poor moonshiners filled the courts during the last 5 years of Prohibition. In 1921, the federal courts of Florida settled 551 criminal cases, 463 of which were federal liquor violations. The Northern District Court settled 164 of those cases, with 121 involving liquor violations. In 1928, the Southern District Court of Florida had more than 2,800 cases pending and settled 1,319. U.S. Senator Duncan Fletcher sponsored a bill in Congress to add a third judge to the Southern District to handle the load. As the number of cases also increased in the county and state courts, and the costs of litigation soared, county sheriffs turned prosecution over to federal agents as prohibition became a luxury that most Florida communities could ill afford. Florida historian Carlton Tebow argued that after 1929, county sheriffs yielded enforcement to federal agents for another reason. He claimed that, quote, local authorities became indifferent, if not outright hostile to enforcement, because they wanted to avoid local political animosities that accompanied the robust efforts to rid local communities of moonshiners. Guthrie asserts that Tebow overstated the case and that county law enforcement provided at least passive support to federal agents. In North Florida, agents, quote, narrowed the field of investigation, bringing fewer cases against well-funded commercial violators with resources to mount strong legal defenses to concentrate on small moonshiners who lived marginal lives, lacked community ties, and/or possessed limited knowledge of due process, end quote.
Connie, Guthrie's use of court records with testimony by prisoners and the community to illuminate the lives of moonshiners is a tedious but rewarding research process.
It is a methodology first introduced by the Annales School in the 20th century when French scholars began using church court records to understand the social history of long transformations through the lives of peasants. It has become an important tool for social historians everywhere. Using court records, Guthrie discovered that impoverished and often marginalized moonshiners did not have the full support of their neighbors or the surrounding communities. Indeed, it was often neighbors who alerted the federal agents to the moonshining activities and who testified in court, providing details about the social and financial status of the accused, as well as opinions about their character. In a rare case, Buchanan v. State in 1928, which was appealed to the Florida Supreme Court, the moonshiner J.W. Buchanan was accused of murder in the death of two federal agents at his Taylor County home. The agents planned to purchase liquor from Buchanan and use that as the basis for obtaining a search warrant. Buchanan claimed that he was acting in self-defense, but a friend of the moonshiner who was present testified that Buchanan invited the agents into the house and shot them on the front porch. Neighbors also recalled that a week prior to the shooting, the moonshiner boasted that, quote, he would walk over anybody that went to search his place, end quote. Guthrie found a number of motivations for citizen complaints that resulted in arrests and convictions of moonshiners: irate customers, other moonshiners who saw opportunities to undermine their competitors, and women who wanted to eradicate the source of their husband's drinking, numbered among the complainers. Guthrie's research also uncovered the reason men, and some women, turned to moonshining. 63-year-old Lena Severance sold beer from her Crawfordville home to make ends meet. She explained the 832 bottles of beer agents found by pointing to her husband's poor health. Quote, we would do nothing else to make a living, she stated. Moreover, she claimed that she did not sell beer, but sold cheese and crackers and gave her customers beer to drink with the sandwiches. John Finley was an elderly paraplegic who sold beer from his grocery store, confident in his belief that, quote, the court would not put him in jail as he was crippled, end quote. Local churchwomen complained to federal agents, and he was arrested in his wheelchair. Times were hard in Depression-era Florida, and especially so in North Florida and the Panhandle. Farmers turned to moonshining to tide them over in hard times. Josh McCall, a backwoods farmer and part-time moonshiner, claimed he was just trying to support himself and his eight children. His partner in crime, Dave Padgett, asserted that he had nothing to do with the still, that he was only in the woods looking for hogs. Prosecutors were not convinced. Charlie Jacobs had been living in Leon County only 3 weeks when he sold a gallon of moonshine to a federal agent. He had come to Florida from Georgia to seek work. After his arrest, he considered escape back to Georgia, but decided to stay and take his medicine in the form of jail time. Race added a new level of complexity to the arrests. Jacobs, a white man, had been living in a black woman's house and selling whiskey to black customers. Levy Thomas, a black tenant farmer, claimed that he was selling whiskey, but the still belonged to his white patron. William Riley rented a shack from a white man who he claimed stored moonshine in the house. Quote, "I don't want to tell on the white folks," he told the agents, "as they would kill me," end quote. Guthrie notes that not all black moonshiners were caught in untenable positions. Some, like Samuel Kilpatrick of Wakulla County, had substantial investment in his moonshining operation. Arrested in 1931, his case was dismissed in 1934 as the 18th Amendment was repealed. Guthrie concludes that the average net worth of poor moonshiners was $74.50 and suggests that, quote, "Prohibition enforcement in North Florida fell unfairly upon poor people largely because federal agents practiced selective enforcement," end quote. With few resources to mount a defense, most moonshiners accepted plea bargains, and the conviction rate rose from 65% in 1928 to 89% in 1932. Quote, "Beaten, bedraggled, and perhaps fatalistic," he claims, "most blamed themselves for their hardships, and when caught, submitted with dignity and pleaded guilty to preserve what little self-esteem they had left," end quote.
Unfortunately, this isn't the only instance in history of a tougher justice system for poorer people. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. This time of year, many people are making resolutions to quit smoking, including cigars. Holly Baker takes us to the Shade Tobacco Museum.
Florida native Drew Padgett teaches history at Robert F. Monroe Day School in Quincy, Florida. He also volunteers at the Havana History and Heritage Society's Shade Tobacco Museum in Havana, Florida. He told me about the once-booming shade tobacco industry and Havana's role as the center of shade tobacco production in the early 20th century.
Shade tobacco is tobacco grown under the shade. It was used mostly for cigar wrapping. So when cigars were really popular, starting after the Civil War, cigars became a preferred way to smoke tobacco. We had a really big boom in cigar production starting in 1870s, 1880s, into the 1890s. It has to be grown in a particular way. You want a leaf that is not only soft and flexible, but obviously one that tastes good too, and that is strong enough to bind the tobacco within the cigar. And shade tobacco was only grown in two parts of the United States, in the Connecticut River Valley, so around Hartford, Connecticut, and here in Gadsden County and a few other counties surrounding, particularly Decatur and Grady County, which is right across the Georgia-Florida border to the north of Gadsden County.
The railroad first came to Havana, Florida in 1902, and soon farming and shipping of shade tobacco became very profitable.
Havana, as a town, wasn't established until the early 1900s. Before that, there were a few communities that had been around since after the Civil War. Salem, literally, this is the name of a place. Coon Bottom is the name of an area, Concord. Not only do you have growers that started growing more and more shade tobacco in that particular area of Gadsden County. Havana's in the northeastern corner of Gadsden County. A railroad was built near the Salem community. And when that railroad was built, people obviously gravitated more toward the railroad. So Havana got its name, obviously, from Havana, Cuba, in honor of tobacco grown in the area. And by the 19-teens, 1920s, we have stores, including fertilizer, feed, farm supply stores. Obviously, we have other community businesses pop up, whether it be restaurants, obviously city government, municipal services. You have theaters, you have stores, you have a bustling small town economy starting to emerge right there by the railroad. And Havana would boom until shade tobacco started fading in the 1960s, 1970s.
For nearly 100 years, almost everyone in Havana, Florida and the surrounding communities worked in the thriving business of growing, curing, packing, and shipping shade tobacco.
Havana, a lot of tobacco was grown in the area. When it comes to its actual processing and packaging, most of that happened in Quincy, the county seat. Quincy is one of the oldest towns in the state of Florida. I think it's like 10th oldest. It was platted in the 1820s, so it has been around a really long time. Even to this day, there are four or five buildings within the town that were built in the 1830s that are still standing. It's a very, very old town. It was very influential, especially in territorial and Civil War Florida, especially being right down the road from Tallahassee. But a lot of packing houses were in Quincy. I think Havana had four. A lot more growing around Havana than actual processing. So Quincy probably had a little bit, or actually had more activity than Havana did. But Havana's culture and identity and history, obviously in its name, definitely tied to shade tobacco. And it, I mean, even to this day, like it is, it shaped the town, and a lot of people are proud of that heritage. And our museum exists for that reason, to make sure that heritage lives on.
The Havana History and Heritage Society Shade Tobacco Museum is housed in the Planters Exchange Building, a historic landmark built in 1928. The Planters Exchange once served as the main manufacturer of fertilizer and supplier of pesticides and farm supplies needed by the shade tobacco growers in Gadsden and Madison counties. The Shade Tobacco Museum is dedicated to preserving the history and the significance of shade tobacco. Drew Padgett.
The goal of the museum has been to educate visitors not only about the community and the heritage of the town, but to appreciate shade tobacco and what it did for Gadsden County for over 100 years. I mean, this was an industry that defined and shaped what Gadsden County became, especially in terms of its demographics and its culture as a primarily agricultural county, even into the 21st century.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, visit our content-rich website at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Holly Baker. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week and a happy new year. I'm Ben Brookmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.